Thank you for joining us for this episode of Talking with Religious Historians. This is a short-form episode of our regular Ecclesiastical History Society podcast, wherein we talk to established religious historians to find out more about their careers and what advice they would give early career researchers. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Betts, a historian of early modern British medicine and religion. Thank you for joining us today. For today's episode, we are happy to welcome Professor Catherine Ryder. Professor Ryder is Associate Professor of Medieval History at the University of Exeter. Her research focuses on the religious and cultural history of Europe in the late Middle Ages, particularly on the history of magic and the church's attitude to magic. She's published two books, Magic and Religion in Medieval England and Magic and Impotence in the Middle Ages. She's also recently co-edited with Sophie Page,
The Routledge History of
Medieval Magic. Today, Professor Ryder joins us to share her experience of academia and give us some advice on public engagement. Professor Ryder, thank you for joining us on today's episode.
Hello, and thank you for asking me. Nice to be here.
We're so happy to have you here. To start off, would you mind telling our listeners a bit about your academic background and how you came to academia?
Well, I studied history at UCL in London, but well before that, I've always really liked history. I remember when I was 11, when I was in the final year of primary school, which is year six now, our teacher got us doing a class project with parish records from the 19th century where we were tracing families. She persuaded the local vicar to let her photocopy all these things. And I absolutely loved kind of looking at these families and thinking about their lives. But I've also been interested in the Middle Ages for a long time. I really liked the stories of King Arthur, things like that. And it wasn't something I had a chance to study much at school. So when I went to UCL, I really liked the breadth of courses they offered, the fact that I could study all kinds of things I hadn't studied at school. And I found a brilliant supervisor there, David Davray, who taught me as an undergraduate. And when I was thinking about PhDs, I went back to him and I said, oh, I'm quite interested in magic. I'm quite interested in the church and marriage. And we talked about lots of ideas. And eventually he said, you do know that there's lots of canon law that deals with magic as a cause of impotency. And it kind of went from there, really. And I was lucky that there's really interesting material on magic and impotence in canon law, in theology, in medicine. So that was how I came to work on that topic, really.
That's really fascinating. I bet that you were a fun person to talk to at parties about that, because I think that people would be quite interested in how does all of this work together and how come the church was interested in this.
Yeah, I think a lot of people thought it was a bit bonkers, but it works really well.
I think it's so fascinating because it touches on so many different areas of life. I mean, you really have to do a ton of research on different things, on science, on the church, on, like you said, on canon law, to be able to really get at the heart of this.
Yeah, and it was nice to draw those things together. So, you know, the doctors obviously talk about it rather differently from how the lawyers talk about it. But between those different bodies of evidence, you can come to something really interesting.
Was there anything specific that you found out that still to this day was a bit surprising?
One thing that I always kind of, that always surprised me was the way Thomas Aquinas talks about it, because he has a little section on magic as a cause of impotence and what the annulment laws are and so on. And he starts off by saying, some people think that there's no such thing as magic, that it's just a label we give to things we don't understand. And this all sounds really modern. And then he says, well, that's complete nonsense. No one believes that. And it just really, it always struck me as something that really illuminates how differently they thought about magic in those days. And I like the challenge of kind of trying to make sense of why that very, very different attitude made sense at the time.
It is difficult to put yourself in that mind frame. And so thanks to scholars like you that help us kind of navigate that a bit, you can maybe make more sense of it. Because I know to us, that just sounds ridiculous sometimes. But when people really believe this, you have to think, why, you know, what was it about the situation that led people to think this? So that's amazing. I wanted to say that you are working on two very different areas of research. So one is obviously about attitudes and responses to infertility in the Middle Ages. And then you also have another area of research, which is on the Roman Inquisition in Malta. So can you discuss how it came about that you also are focusing on Malta, and then maybe help us listeners with how you balance on working on two areas of research at once?
Well, it sort of happened by accident, really, and it's probably not the way to be ultra productive, I don't think, because for a long time I was kind of moving along on both sides of my research and not publishing. So I don't think it's the way to quit productivity, probably, but it's been very interesting. So the Infertility Project came out really of the work I'd done on impotency. It's something I've been interested in since I was an MA student. I did an MA with Professor Jinty Nelson, where I did a dissertation on kind of attitudes to childlessness. And it was something I felt had been really understudied, especially outside the history of medicine. So medical historians had done a bit of work on infertility, and quite a lot more work on reproduction. But I felt that other sources, particularly religious texts, were really understudied. When I started that project over 10 years ago, and it felt then very understudied. That's not quite so true now. There's been quite a lot of infertility history over the last 10 years, including some really good work on the Middle Ages. So I really want to get moving on that project. So that was how I came to be working on infertility. The Maltese project is completely different. It's different period, different set of sources, different context. And I was drawn into that by a colleague in the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies here in Exeter, Dionysius Agius. And Dionysius is from Malta, and he'd worked on the Inquisition records there before. And he wanted to do a project on a trial, an Inquisition trial for magic, for this enslaved Muslim, Selim bin al-Sheikh Mansur, who was accused of doing magic for Christians. And so he wanted a collaborator who knew about magic and could talk about canon law, could do some work with the Latin in the sources. So he came to me and said, would you be interested in teaming up to do this? And it's been really fun. I'd never been to Malta before. I'd never really worked collaboratively like that before. And so I'd learned a huge amount, and we've gone on to do further work together on it. But I think for a while that really held up the infertility work, because we'd had funding to work on Malta, so we did have to actually produce some outputs.
Did you work on both of the projects at the same time, or because you had funding for the project on Malta, did you put the infertility project on hold, or are you some superhuman that can do both at the same time?
I did put the infertility project on hold quite a bit. I worked on a couple of articles quite slowly that came out sort of in 2020 and 2022, but I did put it on hold quite a bit, and also because I had periods of maternity leave and other things and COVID, and that all kind of slowed my research up no end. So I did put that on hold, but now we've kind of reached a pause in the Maltese work. I'm really trying to switch back to working on infertility for the next year or so, and actually try to make progress on the book.
Wonderful. Well, that actually, you mentioned the articles, and I wanted to say, so you have written two recent articles on gendered aging and infertility. And so I just was wondering, could you talk more about your findings and what sources you've been using to research infertility in the medieval period?
Those articles really look at medical texts. So there are sort of medical encyclopedias that talk about lots of different medical conditions, the causes, the signs, the cures. And so I've been using what they say about infertility to think about the relationship between age and infertility. They're quite interesting on, for example, what ages they say men and women are fertile, and whether as a doctor you can do anything about that. They say you can't, really.
What ages do they say, typically?
Well, for women, it's roughly kind of what will make sense with observation. So it's from puberty, which they say is around about 14 onwards, through to menopause, which they put at a whole range of ages, anywhere from about 35 up to 55, 60, depending on which doctor you read. For men, some of them don't say that men's fertility is limited at all, but some of them say that maybe after 70, after 80, it becomes difficult for men to father children.
Is there a link that you're finding between what these medical texts say and biblical views on the topic?
Well, that's something I'm still trying to work through, because what I've done is I've looked at quite a few biblical commentaries on figures like Sarah and Rachel and Hannah and so forth. And they obviously have very different priorities. They're not interested really in curing infertility. But they are, both the medical commentaries, particularly on Sarah and Abraham, and the doctors, are interested in the idea of an ageing, what happens to fertility when you age. There are these wonderful passages in Genesis where Abraham and Sarah both are told they will have a child when they're quite elderly, and they both laugh and talk about how they can't have children naturally because they're too old. So the Bible commentators do talk about that. And interestingly, some of them pick up bits of medical knowledge. So they talk about the theory of the humours. They talk about the fact that it's difficult because your humours change as you get older. Your body changes. Therefore, it's kind of difficult to have a child. And what the biblical commentators are interested in is saying, well, this couldn't have happened naturally. And therefore, it must have been miraculous because only God could have made these two people have a child at that age. So there is an interest there in kind of what happens to the body as it ages and what that might do to your fertility. Although obviously the doctors are interested in whether you can actually cure this problem. And the Bible commentators are more interested in showing that you can't cure it and therefore this is God's action at work.
Right. You know, you do hear about those stories from the Bible, but I don't think I've ever given that really a second thought about them citing medical sources to say, oh, the humors change, or, you know, having a bit of medical information in those stories. So that's really interesting. What a great crossover.
Yeah. They don't all, but some of them do. Some of the commentators do very interestingly. It's obviously not essential. They've got plenty of other things they can talk about too, but some of them do, and it's interesting.
It is. Yeah, that's amazing. So I wanted to switch tacks a little bit, if that's okay with you, because I know you've been involved in a lot of public engagement around your research. And I wanted to hear from you about if you can talk about why you think that's important. And then also for our listeners, anybody that's interested in doing public engagement a little bit more, how have you found meaningful ways to interact with people about your research?
I do it partly because I enjoy it. I find this material really interesting. I like talking about it. And I'm lucky in the topics I research. You know, people are interested in magic. There's a whole Harry Potter effect there. People are interested in fertility. So they're topics that lend themselves to public engagement, I think. What I often do is I like giving talks, but I quite like giving talks that are interactive so that people can talk back to you, can react to the material you're presenting, can ask questions, because you know, that makes me think harder about what I'm doing. There's nothing like being asked kind of questions by someone who doesn't necessarily know the topic and being forced to explain yourself to make you think slightly differently about the topic. So I enjoy that. I think also it's nice as an academic, there's lots of really interesting material out there. I don't just want to hang on to it all myself. I like to share it if people are interested.
It's wonderful when you get to share what you've learned, and you have picked such fascinating topics that I think people probably really clamor to hear more about what you do. But as somebody starting out in ECR or somebody who's doing their PhD outside of maybe giving talks, have you found any ways that you particularly enjoy to do public engagement?
Well, one thing I've been learning recently is our department has recently merged with archaeology, and I've been learning from some of the archaeologists how they do public engagement, and they often do it in a much more interactive way. So I signed up to help one of our archaeology colleagues, Carly Amin, at the British Science Festival recently. And we talked about what I might do. And she said, well, you know, bring some amulets, bring something that people can look at, give them something to make. So thinking about an activity that's not just you talking to people, that's great, I enjoy that. But also that gets people interacting, reacting to the material. And that doesn't have to be anything very high tech. It can be getting people to write things on post-it notes. Or we had another researcher there who got people to play a game matching up illnesses and cures. So it doesn't have to be anything very high tech, but something that gets people to actually engage and interact and come and speak to you, I think is good.
That's a great idea.
And also, I guess if you're an ECR as well, most universities have public engagement teams who will have contacts, who will know if there's a kind of an arts festival or some kind of heritage festival coming up. So don't feel you have to do it on your own. Do talk to people in your university about the contacts they have. One group who approached me through the university were our local university, the third age group. And they're an absolutely fantastic audience for trying things out on, because they'll just interrupt you and ask you all kinds of brilliant questions. But they're not necessarily someone I would have come to just on my own. So do ask for people's advice there and be willing to go along and learn from what other people do as well.
That's great advice. I really like that. I think that you're right. Reaching out to the resources you have, that's something I wish I did a bit more of when I was in university. So I think that's important. An important reminder that those resources are there. We need to utilize them.
Yeah, I mean, this was not a thing at all when I was a PhD student. You know, the impact agenda didn't exist. I wasn't really ever asked to think about public engagement, but it's so much more important now. And there's so much more support available to do it.
And it's so much fun. It's great fun, I think. Like you said at the beginning, just being able to share the cool stuff that you've been able to research and learn about. It's wonderful.
Yeah, well, I enjoy it.
So I will ask you one final question. That's how I like to end all of these podcasts. And that's to ask, what is your favorite part about being an academic?
I think probably it's the variety. So you teach, you research. I also do a fair bit of management and administration, which not all academics enjoy, but I quite do. I supervise PhD students and try to kind of encourage them into the field. So I think the variety of things you can do and the amount of autonomy you have to pursue the things that interest you is really a great privilege.
So great answer. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Professor Ryder, for taking the time and talking to us and teaching us more about some medieval magic.
Well, thank you.
It's been lovely talking to you.
You too.